From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are at the DNC in Philadelphia for the start of the Democratic National Convention. Democrats hoping to present a unified, optimistic front after last week's GOP gathering in Cleveland. And then came the emails. The FBI says it's investigating the hacking of thousands of emails from the Democratic National Committee, emails that showed the committee favored Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz says she'll step down at the end of the week, but first she will step up to the podium at 4 p.m. and gavel in the convention, even after she was jeered today at a breakfast for the Florida delegation.
So, listen, let me tell you this. Let me have everybody sit down for a second.
But they did not sit down. They continue to boo shades of Ted Cruz last week here in the Wells Fargo Center. We just bumped into Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow and asked her, how do the Democrats fix this?
Well, I think it is fixed in the sense that the emails were wrong. People know that. And she has stepped down in the name of party unity.
She's going to still be speaking. We saw her walk out on the stage late last night.
I think she's got to make a decision on that. I want to see as much party unity as possible because the real focus today is on hearing from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and our wonderful First Lady and Cory Booker. And so it's going to be a dynamite night.
Are you saying you'd rather she not be on the stage?
Well, I would prefer if there's going to be divisiveness that not happen.
Also, this is just unfortunate for the Democratic Party because it's about emails. And it's, of course, relaunched all the concerns that were expressed all last week about your nominee, Hillary Clinton, that there's something corrupt, that there's something unsavory having to do with emails. How do you...
But this has nothing to do with that. I mean, there are hundreds of people that work for the DNC, and some folks said something in emails, and they're supposed to be unbiased and neutral in the race, and so what they said was wrong. That has nothing to do. Hillary didn't write those. She had nothing to do with those. I think the bigger question for me is why we have Russian hackers that are getting into the DNC, the question of why they're choosing now to unleash these, and there's a whole bunch of questions I have about Donald Trump's relationship with Putin and his willingness to walk away from NATO allies.
Well, they should say that the Democratic Party says that there are some security officials that have told them that these were Russian hackers and that the party had concern and that the White House even had concern that Russian hackers were going to try to somehow manipulate or interfere with the election. I just want to ask you one other thing about the emails, Senator, because I know you want to talk about your candidate, but it wasn't just that the DNC was seen to be putting its thumb on the scales and favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. There was a tone expressed. There was name-calling. There was, you know, speculation about his religion. It's unseemly. It's unsavory. You know,
well, he was wrong. I mean, I looked at those and I said, you know, that's terrible. That's wrong. And the people that did that, I mean, certainly the head of the DNC needed to step down, and I supported that happening. So things like that happen, and the important thing is how people react to it, because it was wrong. But what we have is a situation where she has stepped down, and we have a great convention ahead of us.
Let's talk about what you hope happens this week. What do you think Hillary Clinton has to do off of last week? What's one message that you really want to hear from her, having heard from the Republicans?
Well, first of all, with the Republicans, it was so much fear-mongering and divisiveness and name-calling. It was shocking to me. What you're going to hear is a very different tone. We really do believe that the country is stronger if everybody's together. We really do respect people of all backgrounds and faiths and lifestyles. And so you're going to see that reflected on the stage. And we also will see the complete story of Hillary Clinton, not just what the Republicans are constantly attacking her on and the caricatures they try to make of her, but, the young woman and Children's Defense Fund attorney that could have gone to Wall Street but decided she wanted to fight to protect children. That's when I met her.
So how ironic that the party worked so hard and managed to have, unlike the Ted Cruz moment last week, managed to at least have some sort of olive branch with her biggest rival, Bernie Sanders, he's going to be speaking. That was removed from the table, and yet he'll be speaking, but there's another person who's going to be trying to get on the stage that many people in the party don't want on the stage, which is Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Well, these things happen in politics, and they always, if they do happen, get blown up, and this has been blown up in the last 24 hours, and I thought it would be settled when she stepped down. And so,
but she hasn't stepped away.
She hasn't stepped away until the end of the convention. And so, but I would just say there's a whole lot more to this. There's a whole lot more to the Democratic values and the party than one person, than any of us. And what you're going to see on display is a wonderful array of thoughtful, caring public servants and people who desperately want to move our country forward together.
Senator Stabenow, thank you so much.
Verizon Communications today officially sealed a deal to buy Yahoo's core business. Price tag, $4.83 billion. Now, that's just a fraction of Yahoo's peak value, which came back in 2000 when it was worth over $125 billion. The sale is something of a swan song for Yahoo. The once pioneering internet company has diminished in the past decade and has been struggling to turn things around. Here with more is Kara Swisher, co-executive editor of Recode. And Kara, Verizon is paying about $5 billion for this deal. So what do they get out of it?
Well, it's a bargain for Verizon to get this big audience for such a low price. I mean, there's smaller companies that are worth in valuation a whole lot more in Silicon Valley. And here's a very large audience, a great brand, a lot of problems, obviously. It's sort of like an old house that has a lot of issues, plumbing and electrical and everything else. But there is some, you know, some good bones to it, some advertising assets, some tech assets. Mail, things like that.
You know, I think one of the things that surprised me most is that Yahoo's core business has 1 billion monthly users. I don't know why I felt surprised that it was as high as that.
Well, that's their numbers. You know what I mean? I understand what they're doing there, but all these numbers are sort of artificially inflated. I mean, they're not Facebook, let's just say. Facebook is the one with the real scale and the real audience. Yahoo's been losing audience. It's been losing market share. It's been losing everything for years now. You know, those numbers are somewhat deceptive in terms of the impact that Yahoo has.
Well, Kara, I'm seeing here a letter from Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer that she sent to Yahoo employees, and she says that basically Verizon itself has some very aggressive global growth projections. They want to grow to 2 billion users and 20 billion in revenue through mobile media by 2020, and that Yahoo could be a central part of that. Now, how might that be possible?
Well, what is she going to say? I mean, this was someone who was saying just months ago that she had a plan to turn the whole thing around. She had no chance but to sell this thing. And that's where it ended up, given, you know, where Yahoo's been, where she's been managing it. And it hasn't worked. Her turnaround hasn't worked. Her efforts haven't worked. And so this is the next best thing, is that it, you know, it does have a lot of mobile users, and Verizon needs to get to these big numbers. You can't just be at, you know, 100, 200 million people. You need to be at 2 billion, 6 billion, 5 billion. You know what I mean? You need to be these big numbers. And Yahoo's one of the biggest scale players on the internet. And so hopefully, if they do things right, they could take those users and turn them into Verizon users.
Now, we should note again that Yahoo's only, it's selling its core business. It still has other assets, a stake in Alibaba and Yahoo Japan. I mean, what's the value of those businesses?
Quite a bit. That's where most of the value of Yahoo is right now. The 30-some billion dollars of Yahoo's market value is all wrapped up in those assets. And so that'll spin off into a separate company. And that includes a lot of cash. Yahoo is about close to $8 billion in cash that will go with the new company. Verizon does not get their hands on that. There's some patents that are of questionable value, but they probably could sell them better in the other company rather than Verizon paying for them. Verizon didn't really want them, except the ones that had to do with Yahoo. And so there's some little things in there, but it's mostly going to be an investment company, and then they'll return the cash to the shareholders, which will be great, and then, you know, sell off the other assets. So it's just selling. It's like owning, I don't know, a car and just selling it off.
Yeah. And finally, Kara, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer obviously wasn't the first CEO at Yahoo that was unable to save the company. But overall, what's your take on her leadership tenure?
I've been a critic. I think she has managed this quite badly. I think they had a chance. She had a lot of goodwill when she came in. I think she frittered away a lot of money on ever-shifting strategies. I think she was had too many sort of grandiose concepts when it was really just a block and tackle fixing of Yahoo. Now, to be fair, to turn around a brand that is in decline is really hard. There's only one Steve Jobs who did that at one point, and very few people can succeed at that. So it's not like it's not a difficult thing. But the idea that that there wasn't a lot of money wasted here and a lot of effort is just untrue. But Silicon Valley likes to do that. They like to say, oh, it was too hard to fix. Meanwhile, they pay themselves enormous salaries and then walk away from failure and act as if it's a success. So it's fine. It was a difficult job. She was unable to do it. And now it's being owned by a company that where it can, you know, they can hide its sins and focus on its assets. And we'll see where that goes.
Well, Kara Swisher is co-executive editor of Recode. Kara, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
It's here and now. Back in Philly at the DNC, abortion has not been mentioned much in the campaign. Security issues are at the forefront. But both major parties have abortion planks in their platforms. Both Clintons, Hillary and Bill, once said abortion should be not just safe and legal, but also rare. The Democratic platform this year calls for, among other things, opposing Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood and overturning the so-called Hyde Amendment, which limits federal funding for abortions. The Republicans call for repealing Roe v. Wade, getting rid of legal abortions completely, and adding a constitutional amendment which would award the same rights that an American citizen enjoys under the 14th Amendment, life, liberty, etc., to the unborn. But the GOP nominee, Donald Trump, once called himself pro-choice. Now it's pro-life. His VP candidate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, is staunchly against abortion rights. So what are strong opponents of abortion to do? Yesterday, we went to Mass at Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul in downtown Philadelphia. Afterwards, we met up with Edel Finnegan, Executive Director of the Pro-Life Union of Greater Philadelphia.
At Mass today, one of the things Bishop Sr. mentioned was for the unborn, the vulnerable, those in poverty, those who are suffering, and that we need to speak to that. And we need to see each other as the beautiful creations of God's love. And I think we're losing that. And I think a big part of that is because we've lost the sense of the dignity of the human person in the womb.
On the lawn outside the basilica, a grouping of white wooden crosses.
It's a memorial to the unborn. We have a moving display throughout the Philadelphia area, and we've had it here at the cathedral. It happens to be the week of the convention. And we're happy about that, to highlight the tragedy of abortion.
Well, and as you scan the political scene, do you have a candidate? Do you feel you have a candidate?
I think whenever people are committed to human dignity and they particularly want to address the lives lost to abortion, it's hard to find the candidate that speaks to all of your issues. And it's particularly hard this year, extra hard, I think, because the Democratic Convention, this is the most extreme platform that they've, I think, ever had. And even Democrats for Life have spoken out and addressed that. And they're having something here this week saying 1 in 3 Democrats are actually pro-life. But that's not addressed at all in the platform. And then the Republican platform is the most conservative that it's been, calling for the defunding of Planned Parenthood, which we absolutely agree with. But I think it's hard when the particular candidates don't necessarily speak to the heart issues that matter the most to pro-life and people who want to affirm the sanctity of human life.
Well, I want to clarify a couple of things. You said it's hard on the Republican side because they have one of the most conservative platforms. Are you meaning that you like their plank on anti-abortion plank?
I agree with the Republican platform on life issues. It's hard because while the platform is the most conservative and addresses issues of human dignity and the sanctity of human life, particularly for the unborn, the candidate doesn't speak to those issues.
Well, that's been the conundrum for many pro-lifers. I think it's the first time in recent memory mm-hmm. that a Republican candidate for president has not been strongly anti-abortion and said so.
Yes, at least said so, I would say.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's also, in the past that he was pro-choice, Donald Trump, he's also supported Planned Parenthood for the other things they do that are good, he's said. Does that trouble you?
What I would say about Planned Parenthood is that they are the biggest abortion provider in the country. The other services that they provide should be provided by real health care facilities so that those women who do not believe in abortion are not subjected to receiving health care there. So if you're in poverty, if you're struggling financially, if you need help for your health care, why are you being forced to go to Planned Parenthood?
Well, because Planned Parenthood,
disagreed absolutely with Donald Trump saying good things were done there. I would also say all you have to do is stand outside any abortion facility in the city of Philadelphia, have conversations with the women that are going in there that feel like they have no other choice to come there, when actually that isn't true. There are healthcare facilities here in the city healthcare clinics that provide many of the same services.
So it's sounding like Donald Trump can't be your candidate.
I think it's a challenge that every year, but particularly this year, for people who want to affirm the sanctity of human life, who believe in that and want to restore respect for the unborn child, it's difficult to get behind a candidate that doesn't speak to that issue himself. It doesn't seem that he understands it. But I believe, that being said, no pro-life person who sincerely holds that belief, if that's your issue, you're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
So
that's just not going to happen.
What about the vice presidents? Do they, the vice presidential candidates, do they make a difference? Mike Pence?
I think Mike Pence made more people on the pro-life side comfortable with Donald Trump. I think Kane made people on the pro-choice side, pro-abortion side, uncomfortable with Hillary Clinton. So people of a more progressive nature are uncomfortable with some of his more mainstream views on abortion, or what seemed to be mainstream views. I would not say they were mainstream, but I understand that. I was watching MSNBC the other night, and Rachel Maddow was very upset about Kane and the pick.
Well, so let's explain it, because he said he's a devout Catholic, and he said he's personally against abortion, but he was for other people having choice.
So whenever someone says they're personally against abortion, what I would say is, why? I would ask them that question. Why is he personally against abortion? What does he believe it is? What does he believe happens in an abortion? And if in an abortion, an unborn child loses its life, his or her life, and a mother is left wounded by that choice, then we need to have a different conversation, and abortion on demand is not the answer.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, and you tell me, if I'm hearing you correctly, the vice president may, on the Republican side, may pull you onto that side, despite your hesitation about the main candidate, Donald Trump. No?
Our organization, the organization that I work with, does not pick political candidates, and we don't advocate. We advocate positions. So I will always advocate the position. What I'm going to do in November, I think there's still time to see how people change. You know, people change on abortion. And I hope that happens with Donald Trump. And I think having a man like Mike Pence on the ticket will probably help.
Do you worry that Donald Trump might change because it's politically expedient?
When I say change, I mean a real internal change. So I mean a real metanoia, a change of heart, which I hope happens with him and Hillary Clinton as well. That could happen as well.
What do you think it says, though, in general, that, you know, perhaps one of the four candidates is against abortion no matter what? There's just one out of the four and against it for everyone. Does that say something to you about maybe your opinion being outside the mainstream of thinking?
Whenever people ask that question of those of us who share the pro-life position, I always respond with a question. So I and people who share my beliefs recognize the humanity of the unborn child. And we understand that abortion takes an innocent life. Therefore, how could we say some abortions are okay? I understand that certain laws are passed are more politically expedient, you know, and so we'll support those laws because they'll protect at least some lives.
I think I hear you saying too, what do I care about public opinion? I mean, what do I care what the candidates? It's your personal belief. The fact that only one of the candidates is strongly anti-abortion doesn't change how you believe.
A big part of our work at the Pro-Life Union is speaking to who the unborn child is and, you know, changing public opinion. That's part of what we're supposed to do. Politics is a different business, and so we recognize that, and there's a practicality that comes with politics. We would hope that the candidates would speak truthfully and honestly about the dignity of the human person. And this year, I think it's just going to be a tough year for that. So,
yeah. Well, actually, just one last question, I'll let you go. Did you watch the Republican convention?
Parts of it, yes.
Were you surprised at how little thundering support of the anti-abortion movement there was?
I think the social issues didn't get a whole lot of play this year in the Republican convention. convention. And I think that is an honest reflection of where we are in this country. I think people are more concerned about safety, security, jobs, their own personal lives. And so people believe that abortion doesn't impact their lives, so therefore it doesn't necessarily need to be addressed. And I think that's what Donald Trump and the Republican convention, they addressed it in the platform. It wasn't really addressed in other ways. I think on the Democrat side, what will happen is it will be spoken about, because I think the party that's extreme on abortion is the Democrat Party. I'm not a fan of the two-party system. Let's just say it that way.
Okay.
Currently, I'm not a fan of the two-party system. I think it puts people who care about human dignity in a really tough position, because I don't think any party is really speaking to that issue.
Edel Finnegan from Pro-Life Union of Greater Philadelphia. We spoke yesterday after church. There is a group called Democrats for Life. And, of course, there are many pro-abortion rights Democrats here in Philly and many protesters. Producer Peter O'Dowd ran into one earlier today outside a rally. C. Cole Dillon from Chicago is on the platform committee. She supports Hillary Clinton and believes Bernie Sanders supporters will, too, if the party makes them feel they've been heard.
We have to invite them into the structure, make them feel welcome, bring your issues. The party will adjust like it did in 1988 when Jesse Jackson did it, like it did in 1968 in Chicago. The party always adjusts. We just have to give them time to feel better about it and come on into the tent.
We'll see. Here at the DNC in Philadelphia, you're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The braying of a donkey there. And donkeys and elephants, mascots of the Democratic and Republican parties respectively, are everywhere this convention season. This election has already seen contentious, even ugly battles between Homo sapiens, but maybe folks ought to be following the behavioral example set by their actual animal avatars. So joining us now with more is Vicky Croke. She covers all things animal for Here and Now. Vicky, good to see you.
Great to see you, Meghna.
So both of these political symbols date back to the 19th century, as you know, Vicky, really popularized in the 1870s by cartoonist Thomas Nast. But in the case of the donkey, it was first used actually against Andrew Jackson in a pejorative sense, but then I see that he adopted the symbol for the donkey's strong-willed nature. So in reality, are donkeys as stubborn as we think?
Yeah, unfair accusation. You know, as one expert said, though, it's best to have them think whatever you want them to do is their own idea. And they are fiercely loyal.
They're fiercely loyal. Okay, so what about on the other side of the aisle with elephants? One of the most common things that we think about them is that they have great memories. What are some other characteristics about them?
Well, the more we know about elephants, the more we realize how smart they are. They're one of the few species to recognize themselves in a mirror, for instance. And, you know, they're smart enough not to ask, do I look fat? They're sensitive and deep feeling, though, and they're just so obviously social. Their bonds with each other are very deep.
Remarkable animals, actually. Yes. So that brings us to a recent study published last week in an online journal. Tell us about their findings.
So in a collection of 9 papers, the study analyzed the lives of 255 elephants in 68 accredited zoos in North America. And obviously, Meghna, the issue of keeping elephants in captivity at all is the center of some heated, heartfelt debates. And this won't settle any of them, but they found that the size of the exhibits, how much square footage the elephants have, has less to do with their overall welfare, but social factors allowing them to have stable relationships, stable bonds with other elephants, even other people, is hugely important, and as is enrichment and giving them things to think about and do.
Oh, so more evidence there of the social complexity of the lives of elephants. Really yes. Interesting. Now, there's news about donkeys in Hawaii? Who knew?
That's right. Super cute donkeys. They've been living and loving, that means reproducing, on the loose for decades across these thousands of acres of open grazing land in and around Waikoloa Village in the western part of the Big Island. And feral donkeys are descended from the ones who used to work on those famous Kona coffee plantations and other farms. And then when they were out of work from vehicles, they were set free. And on their own, life has gotten tougher and tougher. So much of the land around there is owned or leased for cattle ranching. Development has increased, and they face starvation because of drought conditions. And so they've been wandering onto roads and into yards, and some people became irritated enough to threaten to kill them.
Okay, so what happened?
6 years ago, the Humane Society of the United States funded a big organized project along with local volunteers and Brady Bergen, a local equine veterinarian, to rescue 500 feral donkeys. And so they lured them in a few at a time using water troughs, and then people on horseback corral them, give them medical checkups, castrate the males, and then they work to find adoptive homes. In one big effort in 2011, 120 were airlifted to Los Angeles, and then another 300 have been adopted out over time.
Okay, and so how are those donkeys doing now?
It's great. I just spoke to Keith Dane of the Humane Society of the United States, and he says it's great news. They're basically at the finish line. Just days ago, they picked up another 4 donkeys out of the 50 or so that are still on the loose.
Good news. Well, Vicki Croak, host of WBUR's The Wildlife Blog. Vicki, thanks as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's Here and Now, live from the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. I feel like the 76ers are the Flyers for day one of the Democratic National Convention, and it's been a doozy. The Republicans started off their week last week with the Never Trump delegates hoping to get some rules changes. You remember that. Well, the Democrats start off with a scandal, and it hasn't helped their own split between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton followers. The FBI says it's investigating claims that Russians hacked into embarrassing emails from the Democratic committee that showed a distinct bias for Clinton over Sanders. That's salt in the already open Sanders supporters' wounds.
We are here to say that we do not support Hillary Clinton. We will never support Hillary Clinton.
Never!
The DNC has tainted their party for generations to come. They will be hard-pressed for me to vote for a Democratic in a general election for a long, long time.
Well, Jonathan Tamari is Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Inky. Jonathan, what's the talk? What do Democrats do about this? Will it be like the Republican week where each day's scandal faded by the next day?
Well, that's the concern, is that after the rocky week in Cleveland when Republicans were kind of crowing about how badly everything went, that they're kind of
you mean Democrats.
Off. Democrats yeah. were crowing about yeah. how badly things went for Republicans. Yeah, that they're kind of getting off on the wrong foot themselves. And I think there's a lot of attention on Bernie Sanders tonight. And can he himself get up and deliver a message that brings some of his supporters back? But this scandal has clearly made that a harder task and really opened yeah. these wounds.
Well, our own Peter O'Dowd is out on the streets. We're going to hear, you know, sounds from the streets continuously. But what's the sense of what's going to happen here in Cleveland? I know you were there. You know, they had cleared the jail cells for 1,000 protesters arrested a day. They ultimately, over the whole week, arrested 18, I think. And if you went out, it just was not, it wasn't like even past conventions, never mind what was expected for this one. We had a theory that maybe it was because it's an open carry city, and there were people with assault rifles and other people saying, I don't think I want to be in a crowd with someone with an assault rifle. What's your...
We've heard a little bit about that, and there was so much talk about the potential for violence mm-hmm. that I think it did worry people about going there. And in fact, the one protester yesterday told one of my colleagues that he would rather be here where there's not that concern and be here with other Sanders supporters. And I think a big difference, though, as well, is that the protesters on the Democratic side are the kind of grassroots activists, where on the Republican side, the opposition is coming from the elites, less likely the people who are going to take to the streets and more the people who work the back
right.
rooms.
Although we saw what protest there was a lot of it was pro-Trump groups that were out protesting their right to carry guns, for instance. Your thoughts? Is the city ready? We know thousands of police have been deployed.
Yeah, I think that's still a work in progress. I think we're all kind of figuring it out. Like Cleveland, the first day of these things is a lot of figuring out the wrinkles. Where can you go? Where can you not go? You know, the city says it's prepared. They were on the big stage last year when the Pope came. But I think that Cleveland actually went very smoothly, partly because those protests didn't materialize like expected. And so I think there's a lot of eyes on can Philly match that.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about the race itself. We know Hillary Clinton appointing her VP pick, Tim Kaine, or announcing him this weekend. They showed up on 60 Minutes. Let's listen.
I think I'm ready to lead. I'm ready first to be a supportive vice president so that the presidency of Hillary Clinton is a fantastic one. But if something were to put that in my path, as much as any human being would be ready, I'd be ready. And you got to approach it with humility. But, you know, missionary, civil rights lawyer, local official, state official, federal official, like I've climbed and I haven't missed a rung on the ladder. And if it were to come that way, I could do it.
What's your sense of what the Tim Kaine pick means, especially here in Pennsylvania, which is becoming a state divided?
Yeah, I think when you hear that he mentioned missionary, I think that's important to Hillary Clinton. When she tries, she's got a lot of the traditional liberal constituencies with her already. And I think when you see the appeal that Donald Trump is making, particularly to the kind of blue-collar white men, which makes up a huge piece of the Pennsylvania electorate, that's maybe where Tim Kaine can help. And you see that he's had success in Virginia and another swing state winning election. And I think there's a lot of hope that he can help her in that regard in a state like Pennsylvania.
Yeah, which has in western Pennsylvania, you know, a lot of people are going more and more red in their,
right,
in their voting. But on the other hand, you were watching Cory Booker, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, quote, closely. He was a prime possibility.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of people thought he would be a more progressive pick.
He would have been. And that's why I think, again, that you're looking at Hillary going more for that kind of blue-collar white vote, possibly, and also somebody who can step into the Oval Office maybe with more experience than a lot of the other people, particularly Cory Booker.
Yeah. And Jonathan, we just got a couple seconds here. What happens for Philadelphia this week? It's a city that's just, I mean, the construction, the restaurants, it's showing off.
It is. And look, it's an underrated city, and so it's got its chance on the big stage. And I urge everybody to enjoy the culinary scene here. It's awesome. And so definitely a chance for it to show off and kind of get out of the shadow of New York and Washington like it so often is.
And yet maybe not drive in to see it quite now, because it's also one of the busiest corridors anywhere in the world. And here we're having a convention in the middle of it. Jonathan Tamari, Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Inky. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the speaker lineup for the DNC includes plenty of high-profile politicians, lots of celebrities. But tonight, a woman from New Hampshire is scheduled to take the stage and share her story of how opioid addiction has touched her family. Casey McDermott from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
Pam Livengood first met Hillary Clinton at a campaign event in Keene, New Hampshire last year. She told the candidate a story about how her family has been affected by drug addiction. It appears she made an impression, because a few weeks ago,
one evening I was sitting in my living room and my house phone started ringing and my cell phone started ringing.
Then a car pulled up outside her house. Soon enough,
three people from the Hillary campaign were two on the phone and one sitting on the arm of my couch. It's like, okay, you found me. You got me. What do you want me to do?
What they wanted was for Livengood to tell her story to the country at the Democratic National Convention. It's a story she didn't even expect to be sharing in the first place. 15 months ago, her boss at a furniture company in Keene said Clinton wanted to talk to some employees. Livengood didn't hesitate.
My hand shot up in the air first. I was like, oh my gosh, that sounds so exciting.
Livengood works as an assembly lead there, and she thought she would talk a little bit about the challenges facing small businesses. But Clinton had something else in mind.
She said the first thing she was hit with when she got off the bus was substance abuse, and that's where this came from, was anybody comfortable talking about it? And I was. She says, good, don't be afraid to speak up. So I did.
For the last 4 years, Livengood, who is 54, has been acting as a guardian for her 6-year-old grandson, Francis, because of his parents' struggles with drug addiction. After Francis was born, a doctor gave his mother a prescription for some opioid medication, and Livengood says it snowballed from there. Eventually, the state's Child Protection Division got involved.
They called me and said that, you know, if we get one more call on your daughter, we're moving in. And I couldn't have that. I just couldn't have it. It would have broke our hearts, all of us.
In New Hampshire, Livengood's story is not uncommon. The state's seen an uptick in child protection cases in recent years, driven in part by the substance abuse epidemic. Nearly one-third of New Hampshire kids in foster care placement right now are living with relatives. When Livengood sat down at a roundtable with Clinton, here's what she had to say.
The growing drug problem in our area that my grandson's mother can't be quite so responsible. So we picked it up and took over, but we also need to see more for substance abuse help in our area. There's very limited resources here and would like to see something in that respect. Do you have any further ideas?
I do, actually.
Clinton told Livengood that she'd been hearing from a lot of people about this issue, and she vowed to make substance abuse and mental health a priority. She's one of many politicians from both parties at the state and national level who made a nod to drug addiction as part of their campaigns.
I think it was a little surprise
but I think I touched her heart. I really do, because she's reached out to me a couple of times inquiring how Frances is doing. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is amazing.
She's hoping her story might help other families struggling with substance abuse to realize that they're not alone. But above all, she's hoping to get across one message.
All I really want is, you know, just don't forget about the kids.
Tonight, Live and Good is scheduled to speak alongside a family from Nevada worried about the possibility of deportation and a woman from New York who advocates for those with disabilities.
And I hope that I will be standing on the stage talking, and then in November, having been part of history for the first woman president in the United States, that would be amazing.
For Here and Now, I'm Casey McDermott.
Democrats kick off their convention today in Philadelphia, and you'll hear a lot about unity, opportunity, and security. But for many younger voters, one of the biggest issues of this election season is debilitating student loan debt. The total amount of U.S. student loan debt has grown to $1.3 trillion, and some students even rack up debt that reaches into the six figures. But a new report from the White House's Council of Economic Advisers suggests that we ought to be paying more attention to people with much, much smaller debt loads, $5,000 or less. Here to tell us why is Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us every Monday. Hi there, Derek.
Hello.
So let's talk about the who these people are and why or how they acquired this $5,000 or less of student loans. And let's just start with the how. How did they get the $5,000 of debt?
In student debt, as in all things, the media tends to focus on the largest numbers, $1.3 trillion in total student debt, $100,000 in debt for some of these students. But I am suggesting here that perhaps we should focus on the smaller numbers, the full story of the student debt crisis. According to this White House economist paper, two-thirds of people who default on student loans have debt sizes less than $10,000. So we're focused on these big numbers, but the students most in trouble have these relatively smaller debt loads. Why? How, as you asked? Well, people with high student debt have often gone to grad school, which means they're more likely to be employed, more likely to make more money. But it's these students with relatively small debt amounts. They often went to a for-profit school. They were a little bit older. Maybe they dropped out after 6 months or a year and a half. And as a result, they haven't accumulated student debt for 4 years. So somewhat paradoxically, their total debt burden is low, but so are their economic prospects when they leave school, and that makes them more likely to default.
Right. So I mean, as you point out in your piece in The Atlantic today, the graduation rates or completion rates for 2 year or 4 year for profit institutions is what, 40% to 25% respectively. So they've taken on this debt, but they don't even have a degree to show for it at the end of the day, right?
Right. And this is a story that I think exists sometimes in the shadows of a lot of media coverage of student debt. When we think of a college student, sometimes we just think of a middle class teenager, the sort of classic Hollywood college experience. But the typical for-profit student is somebody in their mid-20s, somebody from a first-generation family earning less than $40,000 a year, and somebody who does not graduate from school but rather drops out. The completion rate for these schools is incredibly low. And these people are probably most in trouble when it comes to the student debt picture. Their debt burdens aren't responsible necessarily for raising the total number to $1.3 trillion, but these are the real tragedies we should probably be focused on as public policy people.
And Derek, you point out an astonishing figure. How many more times, or what's the likelihood of someone with $5,000 or less of student loan debt, what's their likelihood of defaulting versus someone who has a much higher debt load?
If you look at the total number of people that have $5,000 or less of debt versus those who have, say, $40,000 or more, those with the smallest number are defaulting 8 times more than those with the largest number. So it is extremely important in the overall picture to be focused on these students, often older students, adult students, with small student debt burdens who are nonetheless the most likely to default.
Right. So these are folks now who have debt. They don't have a degree. They've defaulted, and therefore they're even further hampered because of the default in every other financial aspect of their lives, right?
Right. That's exactly it. You know, they often have no shot at a mortgage because they've defaulted on this smaller debt load. I should say altogether that there are lots of people who are doing okay with their student debt. They're paying it off more or less on time, where the debt can also shape their lives as well. It can push young people into jobs they wouldn't otherwise take. It can discourage them from starting companies. It can delay marriage and delay kids. I am absolutely not suggesting that these aren't all tragedies. These aren't all small stories that we should be interested in. But numerically, I think the press has missed this large story about little numbers.
Well, let's talk about that a little more because, you know, I'm raising my hand, mea culpa. I started off this conversation with that $1.3 trillion number, the six-figure debt load number. I mean, how can we sort of change the narrative now if so many people, so many more people have these smaller debt loads that are hampering them just as much, but we in the media aren't focusing on them?
Well, one thing you can do, I mean, reading the paper certainly helped me fully understand the scope of this problem. Another way that I think about this is that macroeconomics sort of ties this whole story together. In the Great Recession, you saw state tax revenues fall. And so to balance their budgets, states cut education spending to public colleges. So what colleges did with less money from the state is they raised their tuition. Now you have public colleges becoming more expensive. And what that's done is it's driven low-income students into the arms of for-profits.
Right.
And so what's happening now is we have a lot of these marginal students heading to places where they are likely to default.
Got to
take a look
at that. That
strikes me as the most important story.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks, Derek. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.